When I went to college at the age of 18, I actually went over to Stanford University, from which I did not graduate. And I was very much of a thinker. I had absolutely no clue yet that where my life was going to go was going to be in a spiritual direction, because I had no background, and it was like 1967 or something like that. So all this was just beginning to come to life. But I was living in a dormitory. Well, first we were all freshmen there, and of course someone had the idea, which is a valid idea, that because everybody's new on campus, we're going to bring everybody together for the first week and we'll orient you all together. And, you know, so by the time that the classes start, you'll know where you are and you know what you're doing. And I became conscious of the fact that we were all 18, essentially. Most of us were away from home for the first time. There were some children there who had been to boarding schools, but for the most of us, we'd lived at home. We'd just left home. Our parents had bravely and tearfully dropped us off, and we had callously and indifferently, you know, walked away from them, having no concept of what it meant to them. And then we were all there, and we were so terrified. Not really terrified of school, but just terrified primarily of one another is what I was looking at. Just terrified that any one of us would say the wrong thing and be thought inappropriate or gauche or silly, or that two girls would unite against the third, you know, all the different things. And I sort of felt like, however many hundreds of freshmen we were, that we were in what I would have called social gridlock, which was that each person was so caught in their own personal concern for how they were going to survive and make friends or not, that nobody could move. It was like being frozen on the freeway. We were all just like this, and just desperately trying to find a spot. I was as insecure as anyone. A certain capacity to relate socially is something that I acquired after I came to Ananda, that I essentially learned from Swami Kriyananda. I was not born with it. And I almost always felt like the odd man out in any group. But I sort of decided that somebody had to move. You know, just somebody in this group of people had to make a shift, because otherwise nothing would ever happen. This is totally off the subject, but one of my wonderful memories of one of our early trips to India, where often the traffic becomes a very interesting conversation for people who are not raised in that country. And we were in we used to lead these pilgrimage trips to India, and we were in a big tour bus. There were about 30 or 40 of us in this tour bus. And we were in some relatively rural area, I think in the state of Orissa, if I'm not mistaken. And the system for blocking off the road when a train had to come by was a little bit unrefined, and often the trains would get stuck on the road, and it was basically a piece of wood that was dropped with a rope, and trains would sometimes block the road because further up the signals were not together, and the whole thing was happening on the telephones, and the telephone lines would break. And so we found ourselves on this country road, which was it was two lanes across and then with very wide shoulders, and the big freight train was stopped in front of us, and we ended up sitting there about half an hour before that train moved, and we couldn't see anything past what was in front of us. And everybody on our side, gradually, because there was nothing coming this way, the cars gradually pulled around and pulled around and pulled around until we had six lanes of traffic facing the freight train, which of course, and everybody wanted to be ahead. And then of course, what was happening was, on the other side of the freight train, the cars were doing exactly the same thing. And enough time passed that there was a huge number of cars behind us. So when the freight train finally pulled away, you had six lanes on both sides of a two-lane road. Six lanes on both sides of a two-lane road jammed up facing each other. And of course, in that moment, you know, nobody could go anywhere. And it took about another half an hour while the word went all the way back and people back, you know, started backing up. I mean, it was, for us, it didn't make any difference. It was just hilariously funny. But it's sort of like life is like that. We see a little tiny moment And we see a little place where we're going to stretch ourselves out. And so often, so the difficulties we get into is that we're not really conscious of even what's on the other side of the barrier, you know, what the rules are going to be, what the consequences of this behavior are. It seems like one of my favorite phrases for myself is, well, it seemed like a good idea at the time. It seemed like a good idea at the time to do that, and only later is it revealed. Well, I was thinking that gridlock is what made me think of that, but I was back at Stanford in that time, and I just made a conscious decision, which was, I think, based on my ability as an actress. I just decided that I would pretend that I was not afraid. And I would simply act as if I was perfectly confident and didn't have any anxieties about what people thought of me. And I would begin to relate, I mean, sort of like I imagined if I were playing a part in a play, what a confident person would be like. And I started speaking to people and making friends and making inquiries. And actually that day, the day I made that decision, I have one friendship outside of my sister and brother that has continued in all my years at Ananda, and I made that friend that day. That first week of my one year of college, I made this one friend, and I made that friendship just sitting there. I looked around the room and I thought, who looks interesting? This girl looked extremely interesting. I just went over and started conversing with her, which is of course something I could do naturally now, but at the time it was, you know, just beyond imagination. And this incredible energy started happening as soon as I did that, which I recognized later as I got more sophisticated, was gratitude. That people around me were just so happy that somebody was vibing something other than, well, two things, fear, 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 and the second one was, what about me, what about me, what about me? You know, I just turned the thought, and instead of asking what about me, I just pretended that I didn't care. Well, I didn't know anything about the spiritual path. I didn't know anything about affirmations. I didn't know anything about divine energy. I didn't know anything about divine unity, nothing. But I did figure out that fear was not helpful. And through that year, that was the last year of formal women's dorms and that whole thing. So I lived entirely in a women's building. And I just began to perceive that the motivating energy of almost everyone around me was anxiety and fear. That it was just to an appalling degree that people's lives were just simply ruled. Now, these are 18-year-old girls, which I made the decision later was the most miserable demographic group in the world, possibly. Just, you know, totally self-concerned. But it was just like the whole building just vibrated with this self-concern at all times and this anxiety that they didn't know what to do with. I appeared calmer than I was because at least I wasn't as bad as they were. But I made up my own personal philosophy and decided quite simply that fear, as far as I could see, was the only absolutely useless emotion, because all it did was confuse and paralyze and draw our attention so deeply into our own self-concerns that we could never get out of the bubble enough to relate to anything. So I was very... Hi, come on in. We can pull a chair right up for you. Oh, a couple more. Hi, Peter. Okay, let's pause a moment.
Excuse me so much.
It's all right. Happy to have you. Oops. Okay. Nirmoha, do you want a more comfortable chair, or are you all right? Okay. Yeah, why don't you take it, sure. No, pardon me? No, I'm fine. But I, you know, after careful analysis, I decided even anger sometimes has a place, because it allows you to put forward what's actually in your mind. Sometimes, you know, righteous anger, or I would say deliberate conscious anger, which is an expression of anger rather than dissolving into anger. But fear, I just couldn't figure out how it ever served us in a positive, upward moving way. So I was extremely interested, not too many years later, one or two, well, maybe one, when I was given a spiritual book, and I was talking about this somewhere recently. I was at the East West Talk on Wednesday. That one of my first introductions to the spiritual path that went in on a deep level was, I read it in a book of Eastern philosophy, but it's actually a quote from the Bible. And it was the simple phrase, love casts out fear. And because I had already in my youth begun to think that fear was the fulcrum point at which goodness began to be choked to pieces. And because I was also aware of the fact that fear was actually a really deep aspect of my own nature. It's sort of like Swamiji once said, families often have a theme. And to a certain extent, fear was the theme of my family. So I kind of grew up on a nerve wire that was where fear was the Achilles heel of everyone in the family. And, you know, it manifested in different ways. You know, bravado is often just the other side of fear, because there's an inability to be calmly centered in oneself. One is always having to run ahead of whatever it is that's frightening you. But when I read that, love casts out fear, I thought, well, that is a truth that I have been looking for my whole life. Now, the fact of the matter is, that statement is not talking in a simple way, because what that love is referring to is, that's talking about the experience, or even more deeply, the perception. You know, that the foundation stone of this world is love. And that love is the love of the divine for us, and the unity of consciousness that we have with all things, the love of our higher selves for our lower selves, of our this document that Swamiji wrote, which is called The Way of Ananda Sanghis, which that brochure back there that's called the membership brochure, it's right behind Peter's head, includes it. Why don't you just hand that to me? Because I'll just want to hold this up just for the pleasure of doing it. In 2003, Swami Kriyananda took the essence of what is Ananda after 40 years, and he articulated it into 7 points. Now, this is an extremely profound document. And it starts with a single prayer that says, may the divine light awaken and purify my heart and bring enlightenment to all beings. It's about the simplest fundamental thought you can have, and it speaks of many elements that are very relevant to our discussion. It begins with the concept that there is something called divine light, that we're not just living in this world all by ourselves, that there's a power greater than what we're perceiving on an everyday basis, but it also implies that whatever that is can come into me. And it implies also that we have to open ourselves to receive it. But then there is a thought that when it comes into me, it has these very interesting words. First, it awakens, and then it purifies. And purify is also a very important word in this whole context of fear. Because when the fundamental definition of the path of self-realization is that in our true, and someone used the phrase recently, there's a book apparently that's come out called Choose Happiness. It's written by a PhD psychologist. But he uses this phrase, in your authentic self, because he's trying not to be religious. In your authentic self, you will find this everlasting joy. In other words, everything else is an imposition on top of it. So when we speak of purifying something, what we're actually doing is we're removing from it those things that block the expression or the perception of its true nature. Isn't that so? When you remove impurities, what's left is the solid gold or the pure light. So we awaken, the light comes in and we awaken, and we suddenly discover, oh, it really wasn't what it seemed to be. Then we purify, and the light itself purges us of these interfering realities. And then what's left is what we really are. Now, this is a absolutely critical first understanding, because so much of the strain of our lives is this belief that somehow we're trying to get to something. We are not that, and we're trying to get to it. And the effort to try to get to it, and now there is effort on the spiritual path, we all know that. But there's a great deal of difference between trying to acquire something that you don't have and simply trying to relax enough to allow that which would be present if you didn't block it to have the opportunity to come forward. Because one, on one hand, is we're always in a state of lack and we're trying to acquire. I heard a late night talk show conversation when I was driving back from Ananda Village late one night, and someone asked some ordinary advice giver, why are people in America so insecure? And she said, because of all the advertising, which I thought was an extremely interesting answer. She said, because we are always being told that we lack something. We lack the right body, we lack the right clothes, we lack the right makeup, the right hair color, the right age, the right partner, the right car. I mean, really think about it, how constantly we are being told that we need something. And I mean, and think how many of us, and I'm a victim of it as much as, well, perhaps not quite as much, but I am also a victim of it. You just suddenly, it occurs to you, I would be happier if I had. And this sort of internal feeling of incompleteness begins, and then we begin to try to acquire. Some people are completely out of balance with this and end up with horrible debts and things that they don't need and so on. But that was her statement. We're always being told. Now, the truth of our nature is exactly the opposite. The truth is that remove all the impediments to its perception, and what we actually discover is what is principle number one here, which is we believe in a single, blissful, eternal consciousness, which is called Satchitanandam, which pervades the entire universe, unifying it and all creatures in a bond of mutual service. This blissful consciousness is the underlying reality of all existence. Now, people can talk when we start talking about fear, and I can be very practical with you all, and I will be. You know, there's affirmations, there's chants, there's ideas, there's certain prayers. But I sort of believe in solving a problem at the most fundamental level. Because if you solve a problem at the most fundamental level, and even more than that, if you train your consciousness to at least attempt to solve it at the most fundamental level, you won't then just deal with, oh, I'm nervous about spiders. Oh, I'm afraid to fly. I'm anxious that I'm going to lose my job. I'm nervous because I got a divorce. I'm concerned about aging. You know, the medication I'm taking has changed my body, or whatever it might be. But all of those, you see, are some projection of the thought that I'm inadequate because, or I may have to face a painful situation because. So we can be very proactive and dynamic, and we ought to be, to influence the course of our lives in the way that we feel inwardly guided to do so. But if we're always doing that because of this inward push of fear of what will happen if we don't, then really we're never actually acting freely in our own lives. We've had fun. When I use the word fun, that's sort of like has a particular meaning in the context of Ananda. When I asked Swamiji once in front of a large group, I said, oh, what is the purpose of Ananda? He said, to have fun. And after we all stopped laughing, he said, but you have to understand what I mean by the word fun. Fun is to experience the divine within and then to share that with others. May the divine light awaken and purify my heart and bring enlightenment to all beings. That's what fun really is. It's not going out to a nightclub or something like that. Now, we've had a lot of fun as we've been developing our school over here, which is now, we've had it for 17 years, so it's hardly new. But Because in order to make these things manifest in the lives of children, you have to break them down to their essential elements. And when we were starting the school here, we were curious as to what was going on in other of the private schools. Partly at that time, for the first 6 or 7 years of the school, I was the admissions director, which was a little bit of a overnaming of my abilities in the area, but it was the beginning of any project is what I would call just generic entrepreneurship. And so David and I are both very good entrepreneurs, so when, it didn't matter that it was a school, whether it was a school or a restaurant or a hotel or whatever it was, they're just fundamental things you do to get something off the ground. So I played the role of admissions director, and I know enough about it to do it well. And so I went around to see some of the other private schools in the area because the parents would ask us, what's the difference between your school and this one, and why I'm thinking of that one and this one. They were obvious questions. We went over to a school, it's called Nueva. I mean, I don't mind saying the name of it. It's an extremely well-respected school. Somebody, some decades ago, the Crocker family gave them this huge mansion in Hillsboro, so they have just a setting that just to die for, this gigantic, beautiful house on this land. And they're very competitive to get into. You know, you could only even get in there if you have an advanced IQ. So they have a very, they're able to run a really remarkable program in that school. And of course, everybody nowadays is really into self-esteem. That's how they define it. It's not enough to educate them. You have to also build their self-esteem. Of course, everybody tries to build their self-esteem without any concept of a reality beyond the ego. So self-esteem means to make the ego more and more secure, except the difficulty is that the fundamental fact about ego is it's very, very insecure because it's a taking of the universal truth and isolating it into a tiny twig and then trying to make that twig be the base of the tree. I'll come back to that in a moment. But they had, literally in this school, they had this, on the bulletin board, they had a self-esteem tree. And I don't think it was the whole school, I think it was like the fourth and fifth grade. And all the children in that class had made a little leaf that was the reason that they could hang on the self-esteem tree, and that was gonna, everybody was gonna show why they felt great about themselves. There were maybe 30 or 40 leaves on that tree. And I stood and I read every one of them. Of the 40 or so leaves, 39 of them dealt with some external thing that child was capable of doing. My team won first in the soccer competition. You know, I got all A's on this. I made a very high score on this grade. I'm in the top 2% of that. I'm taking these advanced classes. I'm learning, some of them were, at least they were learning something. I'm learning horseback riding. I'm learning the guitar, and therefore, I feel like a worthy person. And one person had written, I feel good about myself because I'm less moody than I used to be. You know, some level of self-mastery. All the rest of them were taking their energy and accomplishing. I mean, I'm all in favor of accomplishment. But I just watched that. I said, well, what happens to all of these leaves on the tree when some circumstance takes it away from them? The guitarist gets carpal tunnel syndrome, you know? Or the student reaches their natural level in math, or there's a whole invasion of other students and they go from being first to 25th in the class because there's people who are so much better than them. You know, what happens if they just blow out with this incredibly unbalanced educational system and don't want to do it anymore? But all of it was based on, this is the external world, I've mastered the external world, therefore I'm secure. Now, the problem with that is, there's about 1,000 things wrong with it, but not the least of which is, we don't really have control over that world, do we? I mean, if for no other reason, look at what's happening to the economy right now. And we've been fortunate in our country. I mean, not all of you I know were raised in this country, but we've never had a war on our soil. What about those poor people in Lebanon? What about those poor Palestinians in those refugee camps? What about those poor Israelis who are so confused and they don't know what they're supposed to be doing right now? Or you find yourself in Rwanda, where you have lived side by side with these tribes for all these years, and suddenly they turn and start literally hacking each other apart with machetes. Like, if our sense of strength in life is based on the fact that the world is going to damn well stay in the position that I put it, I mean, even if we can hold that, we know it's not true. I mean, sometimes you see this most unbearable tension in medical doctors who are trained that the whole issue is that they're responsible for life or death. I was in a very unusual situation once where this man who had been part of our congregation, who'd been very strong, he was a runner, but he was having some pain in his back. And finally he went in to have a test and discovered that his spine was absolutely eaten up with cancer, that he was in just the last, literally, weeks of his life. And he went from having a backache when he was running to being in the hospital and really knowing he was never coming out. And then various things happened and he ended up on a life support machine. And he didn't want to be there. And even though you can't communicate once you're in the, on the respirator thing, it was just agreed that his life would be over. And he was actually very brave about it. And so I went over to be there when at 3 o'clock they were going to turn off the respirator. And he'd been largely unconscious, but when I came in at like 2:30, he was fully awake. He was fully awake, he was fully cognizant. He knew that in a half an hour they would turn off the respirator and he would stop breathing and that would be that. He was totally calm. I was very, very impressed. And he was fine, I was fine. His wife was pretty okay. It was the doctors who were totally freaked out. You know, and they were just so nervous about this absolutely inevitable and natural end to things. And they insisted on giving him some sort of pretty heavy narcotics. And I said, you know, he's fine. He doesn't need to be drugged. And I tried hard to even speak to them about why it wasn't fair to him to drug him at that point, that if he had the courage to face death calmly and consciously, why take that away from him? But it was like, there was no place in that room for that conversation. And, you know, we tried, and I did successfully, you know, sort of make of that transition something uplifted. But, man, those doctors were so nervous. They were just so nervous by my direct and, relatively speaking, fearless confrontation of the one thing that they never deal with, which is that sometimes people die. And it was almost, I was like saying, like, what business are you in? You know, you're an oncologist. Every time this happens, do you just put your head under the pillow and run away? And a lot of times, unfortunately, that's true. Now, that's a very extreme example. But how many of us in our lives are really building our confidence on an absolute basis of sand? Which is that we're going to feel fine as long as I can stay in control. So we carefully secure our money, we carefully secure our relationships, we carefully secure our education, we carefully secure our profession. It's all ego-identified foundation for having a confidence in life. And sometimes you have the karma to just sail through. You know, everything just goes well and nothing ever blows up in your face and you just get to die with all that intact. And people think that that's a successful and a good life. Is it? That you managed to just sort of pull off the delusion and never, nothing ever interrupted and asked you to get bigger than that delusion? Is that actually good karma? You see? So much of what we think of as good is that it doesn't touch our fears. And when it touches our fears, we begin to think of it as bad. But what you have to appreciate is that when the center point of our consciousness, no matter what we're dealing with, is fear, everything is distorted from that point. When I was about 18 or 19 years old, when I quite early in my conscious life, I became aware of the fact that I was, relatively speaking, a very harmonious person. There was a period in my life where my personality almost mutated into this. I was very quiet, I always took a background role, it was not the person that I really was. But I became very afraid of creating disharmony around me. And it was just to a certain extent the way I was raised. My father especially basically had no equipment for dealing with conflict. So his mother had been very dominating and he just basically got through by not making any trouble. So he became very anxious whenever there was conflict. My mother would have liked a good argument every now and then, but my father wasn't up for it. I inherited essentially his point of view that if people start raising their voices at each other, it's probably the end of the world. So whatever we do, we should avoid having that happen. So I had this harmonious personality, seemingly. But I began to be conscious of the fact, the way I would describe it, let's see, where's my pen now? Was that the rays radiating out from my personality looked very harmonious. And then I began to study spiritual things, and I discovered that, you know, God is bliss and we're all one. And so I began to have even like this wonderful spiritual justification for this wonderful harmonious attitude. You know, aren't I a spiritual person? And it took me a while to realize that even though the behavior, I'll use the word, was nice, the actual reason for it was not nice at all. The reason for it was this incredible fear of what might happen if I wasn't nice. It was a very common psychological thing. It was news to me because it was the first time I thought about it. And I realized that whatever the basis point is for whatever you do, all your motivation is going to be because of that. And when we make really stupid decisions in our lives, almost always it's because somewhere we had this tremendous anxiety, and therefore we projected that it has to be this way out onto the world. What if I actually cognized that my child is really taking drugs? What if I really saw that, you know, my company is going to fail and I'm going to lose my job? What if I really saw that this man I'm married to is an alcoholic? Oh, no, 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 no. No, 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 no. And then sooner or later, of course, the truth is the truth. And then when it hits us, it just kind of gallops in from the side and smashes into the middle, and we're so shocked, aren't we? You know? So I began to realize that it doesn't really make much difference how you behave. What makes a difference is that you're clear in the center of yourself as to what reality really is. And even if you decide, which I've often decided, well, not often, but one friend of mine, she had a person that she had to work with in the context of Ananda. She found him extremely difficult to work with. And she wrote to Swamiji just about how awful she found this man. This man had a genius for, even in Ananda, these things happen. The man had a genius for sensing people's weaknesses and exploiting them. It's a very unfortunate quality in him, but he was very good at it. And my friend, who was no sloucher, she was very strong, she wrote to Swamiji and said, you know, this is hard for me. And Swami wrote back about the manipulative man. He says, he just wants to be your friend. And my friend wrote back, friend? She said, I don't even want to be in the same room with him, you know? And another friend had a similar exchange about another man, and Swamiji just said the same thing exactly. He just wants to be your friend. In other words, his bad behavior is also coming from this inner anxiety. And my friend answered him in that case. She said, sir, I just don't want to be that good. Now, it's all right, is what I'm trying to say. See, we think that if we look and really call ourselves what we are, that somehow that makes us less. But if we can call ourselves what we really are and replace whatever it is in the center of us that's afraid to be what we are with the fact that, well, I'm timid. You know, I don't want pain, no pain. Right, I'm lazy. Even to say the word, I'm afraid. But if we can actually stand and just see what it is, then at least everything that happens from that, you know, has only, the only problem it has is what the problem actually is, instead of having not only the problem, but the great fear of looking at it. Do you see how complex that gets? In my own life, when I realized that my nice was all really based on a lack of courage, I started not being so nice. And it was a tremendous effort not to be nice. I was, this experiment for me happened at an ideal time because I was living in New York City, which I did for 3 months this summer when I was 19 years old, and I had to learn not to be nice. And the thing about New York City is that nobody is nice. And nice in New York is just like incredible to Californians. You know, people think that they hate you and they're just basically conversing. So it was extremely easy to learn to be blunt-spoken and aggressive and, you know, defending myself and taking my turf in New York, because that was just the way everybody was. And I could just mimic the world around me. And I just started being like that, primarily with strangers. I didn't have the courage yet. The real person I needed to speak up to was the man I was living with, but I didn't do that. That was too much. But I learned to deal with everyone else around me. And then it got to be, it was sort of interesting, because by the end of the summer, I began to enjoy being aggressive and unkind. You know, I began to look for ways in which I could express myself with, you know, self-dominating will and tell people to get out of line, that's my place in line, and tell the grocer to get his thumb off the scale and don't you try to steal from me, and, you know, and that's my taxi cab, and all the things that you do in New York, and hey, bub, get off the sidewalk, I was walking here. I mean, you know, just ridiculous things that are completely meaningless. But I discovered that you just don't have to be afraid to be able to just live like that. And then when I began to enjoy it, I was then able to ask myself, who do I really want to be? Because then the center point of that decision was no longer fear. The center point was, okay, I can be whatever I need to be. And what's so interesting about that is, what that gradually turned out to be in my life was that in the position that I've had since then, which I did not have then, where I have to deal with a lot of people, and I have to deal with a lot of things that people go through, and I often have to manage very complex situations, one needs to have access to all the dimensions of human nature. You know, you can't just have like one or two little things that you can do. I can work with people who are soft-spoken and who are really kind to me, but if anybody challenges me, I just have to run and put my head under a pillow. I remember that I had this encounter with a woman friend of mine. We were working on a very difficult project, and she was a very feisty gal. And one day I just realized, this woman just wants to have a fight. She just needs somebody to fight with. And if I don't fight with her, she's going to fight with somebody who's going to be much more problem here. So it was really fun for me. It was like a sort of like a little graduation exercise. She raised her voice at me, and I raised my voice at her, and she said something insulting to me, and I said something insulting to her. And we just sort of shouted at one another. Now, once again, in her world, this is just basically a lot of how she related. She grew up in a family where everybody yelled at each other all the time, and they slammed doors, and you know, that was just life. I laughed once, a friend of mine, there was a marriage between an Italian and an English person, and when the marriage finally broke up, and the English person was so bewildered that the Italian half of the relationship had never had any comprehension of what was going on in their mind, the Italian said, well, nobody was breaking dishes against the wall. I didn't know there was anything to be upset about. You know, it's like in their world, if you're not smashing crockery, you're not really having an experience. Merely to say, like a British person would say, pardon me, I find this quite upsetting, wouldn't register. You know, but you have to be able to go into people's realities. Now, I really realized that the extent to which I don't have access to my own nature, to that extent, I limit my usefulness. Do you understand? So I just had this screaming fight with this woman. I was never actually angry. In fact, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the fact that I could do it. She enjoyed the fact that I was fighting with her. At the end of it, we laughed, and everything just went on. Yes, Alfonso.
I have a question.
Uh-huh.
I understand, you know, exactly what you're saying. When I come to the consensus, you know, like, in order to be less fearful, you have to be you.
Okay? Yes.
Find out and feel that you need to be you. But when you are, you realize that all of that means a whole bunch of other consequences.
Right.
Even though you are happy to find out who you are, finally, and you're ready to face it.
Right.
At the time of facing it, okay? Even though it's like you're breathing, you know, fresh air on the
right.
way, because a whole bunch of other fears go away,
mm-hmm.
a whole bunch of other ones come in.
Yes, of course, you go up to a higher level and then you look down.
And then you have to even build yourself up with even more.
But see,
the
thing is, what you need to do, and this is really where we are, I mean, by way of introduction, I've been speaking of these things. There's two bases for courage. One basis is I'm a competent person and I can handle it, or everything's going to be okay because I have my systems all in order, which is another variation of I'm a competent person. Or the opposite of that is I'm an incompetent person and nothing's ever going to work out. You know, look at me, I didn't graduate from school, I've lost every job I have, I have no skills. You know, it's just sort of like it's the worldview that says the ego self makes it happen. And if it's a competent ego, it feels secure. If it's an incompetent ego, it feels insecure. But the entire basis for that security is who I am on an egoic level. And what that means is just basically everything. You know, your gender, your age, your education, your skills, your lack of it, all of that identity on the outside. Now, there's very good reasons why we should develop our ego self to be as refined and as competent as possible, because the reason we don't is usually for limitations of consciousness that we need to overcome. But I can come back to that in a minute. The other basis for confidence in life is because the foundation of all creation is Satchidananda, and we are an integral part of that. Satchidananda means ever existing, ever conscious, ever new joy. And it's not even that God loves us, it's that we are a part of all that is. I know every week many of you come to this for our Sunday service. We have the Festival of Light. You are a part of all that is. We say that in several different places. Share with others as God has shared with you, for you are a part of all that is. And we say that over and over, week after week, because that is the only basis for courage, is that you are a part of all that is. Now, all that is often includes freaky experiences. You know, civilization spiraling out of control, other souls on this planet who are also part of Satchidananda but are acting out this dark reality, and that dark reality may intrude upon yours. So we can never find our security from the idea that we have walled ourselves away from anything that's going to frighten us. We have to constantly just go back deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper to wherever we find that point of view that is the origin point of everything else. And even if, you know, out from the trunk of the tree, there's a big storm raging in the leaves, because often there is. You know, we've gone out on an adventure. Now, the adventure of self-expression, which is, I'm coming in a sense, the adventure of self-expression, to learn to do things and to do them well and to be able to respond to the conditions of life, is an exercise in the development of consciousness. It's not in and of itself an end point. Yes, we may do very good work. We may get into a profession where we're very effective and we actually help a lot of people. But what we're primarily doing by that action, or by making little beautiful greeting cards or raising our children or whatever it is that our life is about, what we're primarily doing is every day we're having the opportunity to learn to express our inner nature with fewer and fewer obstacles to the power and clarity of that expression. And when we refuse to engage, either through twisted philosophy, which says, oh, it's just a dream anyway, or out of lack of self-confidence, so we're afraid to put ourselves out, or just fear, I don't want to be committed, I just want to hide in this corner, what we're actually saying is that God is giving us an opportunity to make our consciousness bigger by pushing through and expressing, by overcoming our laziness. I mean, we have these lists of the seven deadly sins: fear, laziness, pride, you know, all of those different things. The reason for excellence is because the pursuit of excellence externally is the pursuit of self-mastery internally. And if we master ourselves, that is what lasts. You know, I was touched by, I can't remember the name of the musician, but some great violinist gave a concert. And afterwards, someone said, oh, I would give my life to be able to play like that. the violinist that I have. It's like, how do you think I got like this? I've given my life to it. And yes, now I can play like this, but it's been that everyday discipline to do it. You see, I see Swami Kriyananda, you see Swami Kriyananda, some of you also. He's the founder of Ananda. I always point, we're always covering up his picture. There it is, right there. And he's been on the path, he's been a disciple for 60 years. He's been absolutely dedicated on a minute-by-minute basis to the practice of what he teaches and what Yogananda teaches, and you see that it's worth it. You see the fruit of that unrelenting effort. I remember just a small incident, but many years ago, he was planning a trip to Europe, and at that time I helped make his travel arrangements, and he had to stay in London, at an overnight in London, on his way to probably Italy even then. And he was, you know, he'd been very busy. He was looking forward to having a little time off. He was going to have that 24 hours in London. And then he thought of the small group that Ananda had in London and a few devotees who were there and how much they might like to see him. And so he was going to make the phone call. And he sort of was, put his hand on the phone, took it off, put it on, took it off like that. And I said, you're torn, aren't you? Between the desire to have that evening free and the wish not to have to reincarnate just to have the willingness to meet with these people. And he absolutely agreed. That was just exactly what it was. So he picked up the phone and he dialed. I mean, we were just joking. But it's like we're always at that edge. If I don't face it now, I'm just going to have to face it later. And the single most powerful way I have found to overcome fear, well, first I'll put it in the negative. There was this couple, and I'm afraid their marriage was doomed, because after a short time he announced to me that his wife had basically two options. Either we did it her way now, or we do it her way later, he said. And there was just nothing in between, and she was an extremely stubborn woman, and eventually their marriage broke up, because you really can't live like that. But that fact is a very interesting fact, because either you expand and face it now, or you expand and face it later. And you have to have a certain amount of wisdom philosophy really deep inside your consciousness, but you see, you build your courage from a lot of different angles. And one way you build your courage is you study the truth as you understand it, and you work as hard as you can to really get that and to practice it whenever it's easy to practice it. When I was caught once in a family crisis, and the dynamic was that I was the one who had to keep it all together and just keep the whole scene running when everybody else was just, you know, falling to pieces left and right around me. And I'm pretty good with other people's crises. That's a particular talent that I have. Everybody else's emergencies, I just get really strong and clear. So I was holding it together pretty well, but finally it just was too much, and it involved hospitals. And so I was in the parking lot of the hospital sitting in my car, which was the only place I had a little privacy to just come to pieces. And I was just coming to pieces, you know, with a big box of Kleenex and the sobbing and everybody suffering and I can't do this and, you know, why are you asking this? I was just doing the full nine yards of what we do when we do that. And then this little voice, I felt it almost like a bug. It was really just a voice, but I felt it like just kind of come in like this, and it burrowed into my ear, and then it went right through my brain and then kind of sailed out the other ear, and it said, do you think what's happening is outside the will of God? And then whatever that little thing was, it just went away. Now, for decades of my life prior to that moment, I have been practicing the idea, at least, that everything that happens is an expression of God's love for us, and everything that we do, we try to make an expression of that. And when everything is really just beautiful, and God has found me the apartment and the new car and has given me the job and the lovely co-workers and the nice partner and all of that, then you can always say, oh yes, you see how God blesses me? But then when God puts you in the middle of a torture chamber and takes all of that away from you, then all of a sudden it's like, well, I believe in God if it agrees with me. But I had a deeper faith than that. So it was sort of like, I must say my first reaction was, damn. It's just like, I want to be upset. I want to be rebellious. I want to be weak. I'm tired of being strong. I don't want to be accepting. And there I am, and I'm trapped. Because if it's not outside of the will of God, then what am I crying about? And I just stopped crying. Why are you crying? God is doing with you and everyone in your life what the divine power knows is best, because it's the next step to expanding everyone's consciousness. And, you know, questions like, do you think all these people, including yourself, are completely self-realized and have nothing to learn? Do you actually think it's a victory just to be left in kindergarten until you die? Somebody has asked us to face something challenging, and here I'm sobbing about it in the car. And just I was caught. Now, it's extremely important at the same time, though, and Alfonso, this is a little bit of what you're asking. You have to be absolutely sincere. Sincere is an extremely powerful word. Swamiji once was passing out compliments, and he was saying really what to me sounded like really promising things about everyone, and he wasn't saying anything about me. So I sort of like put myself, you know, as carefully as I could in his line of vision, so he really had no choice but to say something to me. And he said, "Oh, Asha, you're very sincere." I thought, you know, damning with faint praise is how it sounded to me. And I kind of, you know, just said, well, that was just because you stuck your little face, you know, into the stream of things and forced him to say something. So I thought, scraped the bottom of the barrel. And so a couple of days later, in some context or another, I said something self-deprecating, just to be humorous, like, you know, everyone else is really spiritually advanced and I'm sincere, like that. I don't remember the details, but that was about it. And Swami looked shocked. I mean, he just looked shocked. Not only did he not think it was funny, he looked shocked. And then very seriously, he looked at me and said, "Asha, sincerity is everything." And it was like, I didn't even know what the word meant. I had to just really stop and think. And I have a lot since then. And sincerity is just being exactly what you really are, acting exactly from whatever you understand, you know, with complete integrity. But you see, if you act from exactly what you are with complete integrity, you see how much power there is in that? In all the counseling that I've done with people for so many years, you know, oftentimes I'll counsel someone, sometimes even for years, and everyone else will tell me what they really think and what they really feel, but when they come to me, for some reason, they feel they have to play out some picture of who they think they're supposed to be. And I mean, it's just impossible. Because if a person is not being sincere with you and really giving you their reality, what can you give them back? You have to give them the same superficiality. And you can't force them to be sincere. That's oxymoronic right there. But I've learned to say to people, you know, I really don't care what you think. I really don't care what you feel. I don't care what you've done. It just doesn't make any difference to me. If it's what's happened, just put it on the table and we'll work with it. The only thing I can't work with, I said, is the lack of truth. Because if we're not telling the truth to each other, where do we go from here? We just play some game on this side. Well, sincerity is being completely true with yourself. Well, I'm in the car. And God tells me that this is his plan. And so I want to be sincere. And I have to say, I think this is about the rottenest plan I've ever seen. I'm not really quite sure what you think you're doing here, but it's pretty obscure to me. And I also wanted to announce, in case he hadn't noticed, that I was just going under and I really didn't know how much longer I could drag this, you know, wheelless cart across the rocky plains of all these people's difficulties. And then I prayed like Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. He says, "Lord, let this cup pass from me," meaning let these people accept what I have to give them instead of their crucifying me. But then he says, "Thy will, not mine, be done." And I sort of figure if Jesus can complain about God's plan, then he's setting a good model for us. So we can say, you know, my honest attitude, Lord, you asked me. I think so-and-so was stinky and I don't want to be nice to them. You know, I'm really exhausted with all these problems that you've given me. I just do not know how I'm going to cope. So I would really like you to take that into account, you know, when you're deciding what I can and can't handle. Mother Teresa said, God never gives you more than you can handle, but sometimes I wish God didn't trust me so much. And I just, you see how winning that is? And how much more powerful on every level, because then you're standing on solid ground. And even if you spend a whole incarnation just saying, you know, I'm tiny and I'm weak and I'm never going to deal with it. Yogananda had a disciple, and that disciple was timid. And Yogananda used to say, he's my baby because I'm babying him. You know, and it was like explicit between the guru and the disciple that the disciple was too scared to actually be guided. But he was still master's disciple. He was just going to be Yogananda's little baby. Now, God will or won't respond to us. But it's all right to say what you feel, because it's your relationship with yourself and your relationship with the divine is like any other relationship. The same rules apply. Just straight up openness and absolute sincerity create a tremendous amount of magnetism. And one last thought, and then we'll take a break. Often, most of our fear is just the fear of admitting it. The fear of admitting it. There was this woman who was extremely insecure, and her insecurity basically just made her neurotic. Again, she was quite talented and had many fine qualities, but she was always so insecure. Swamiji said once to her, just for the sake of experiment, let's assume that everything you fear is true. You know, let's just say, make a list of everything you're afraid is true, and let's just say it's all true. And then let's just start from there. I mean, I at one point in my life, I had to face the fact that maybe I had made such a bad mistake that it was going to really pretty much wipe out the whole story. And so I just said to myself, okay, so I've made a really bad mistake. I'm really now, let's just say I've fallen off whatever progress I've made and I'm at the bottom. So, and then I imagined myself dying and having to face my guru and God and guru. And I thought, what can I build from here? You know, given the fact that all the gains have been wiped out, what can I build from here? You know? Now again, think how winning that is. See how that just takes everything away? And it takes it all away on a solid foundation that nothing can pull the rug out from under you after that. So let's take a break now. It's